This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And my guest today is Dr. Yaacob Abba Omar, Director of Operations at the Mapungubwe Institute, MISTRA. MISTRA stands for the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection and Analysis, I suspect, the A.
No, we added the A more to make it nice sounding. So often when people ask what it stands for, we say it stands for action, actually.
Okay.
But no, it doesn't stand for anything.
We will call it MISTRA just to keep, or Mapungubwe, just to keep everybody honest. And we're continuing this year because it's an election year in this country and actually 70 other places in the world, which is fascinating in itself. We've been talking to various political figures and various party animals, and increasingly to think tank and research and analysis people, not so much on picking the winner or loser in an election, but to understand the landscape that elections are taking place in. I think that's actually more interesting to audiences rather than just saying, oh, and by the way, so-and-so is going to win, so thanks very much. But a little bit more information about our guest. This is his second stint at Mapungubwe. He was in the middle of those. He was head of strategy for the Banking Association of South Africa. So we'll ask him for some investment tips. He's had a diplomatic career for South Africa as well. He was an ambassador twice, once in Oman and then in the United Arab Emirates. And he's also been deputy CEO of the Government Communication and Information Systems. And he was general manager for corporate affairs at Arms Corps. Okay. He is, I describe him, I guess, as a scenario and futurist planner at senior government levels. And he's lectured on this topic. And I first met him almost exactly a year ago. He gave a presentation for a business association that I went to that I thought was a model of both concision as well as elaboration. And that may sound contradictory, but it was concision because the salient points were there crisply, one right after the other, and elaboration because each one of them got a fine-tooth comb analysis, a close-up look. And I was starting to relook at that set of documents this morning. And I guess my first real question is, in 2023, you set out an analysis that was mildly optimistic, or at least wasn't really gloomy. It didn't send us all away going, oh dear, the end is here now, it's coming tomorrow. Instead, it was mildly optimistic. There was some hope. Now a year has passed, and you've had a chance to reflect on your own thinking about this. Are you still in the same place, or are the trends pointing downward? Are they giving us more to worry about?
I think I'll probably remain an eternal optimist. And that's probably my self-diagnosis of the condition I suffer from. But I think the signs are there. If we were to just maybe start with a very broad picture, pick a winner for the 2024 elections. I think for me, the fact that there's so much of uncertainty of what the outcome of that election would be is one of the true indicators of how democratic our society has become and is, and has been for the past 30 years. So for me, that's a really, really good sign. I think there's a number of issues around energy, around employment, the economy, fighting crime, corruption, climate change. There's a lot of reasons that I feel, we should be optimistic. But I think I always have the caveat that it requires a lot of hard work. And I'm glad that in many ways, the business sector in particular has been, they've really been struggling to come to the party. And you know that within the ANC, there's a lot of differences on how they see business and whether they see a hidden agenda, business and that kind of thing. But I think, we've got probably the most pro-business president at the moment. And he's been ensuring, you know, whether through working groups or concrete sort of secondment of people from the business sector into parts of government, etc. So there's a lot going on. And I kind of almost describe it, you know, you use the metaphor of the plane landing or coming down. I feel the metaphor of planes that are in their runways preparing to take off. So if you look at the energy thing, you know, there's so many, you know, you speak to the banks and they'll tell you that there's so many projects that they are in the process of either evaluating, processing or funding, whether it's alternative renewable energy sources or just alternative sources, whether, and especially given the kind of latitude that government policy has been allowing for business to start getting into it. If you look at, you know, so many more cases of local governments also being to say, you know, we can begin moving to getting off the grid and that kind of thing. Now, obviously, you know, that is the advantage of scenarios. You kind of look at it on both sides, you know, that, yeah, maybe, you know, it, Stellenbosch can do it, but can Khayelitsha do it, you know, that kind of thing. But the fact that, you know, you've got municipalities that are able to begin talking about getting off the grid, large corporates getting off the grid, et cetera, it just reduces the pressure on the ESCOM systems, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of those kinds of things that are indicating that, you know, we are slowly getting it together.
I'm interested, you brought up energy is sort of your measuring stick, or almost your metric for judging whether the plane is revving up to take off, or they forgot to put fuel in it, or it's about ready to crash, or it's going to auger into the ground. Interesting metaphor, an airplane on the runway. And some of the passengers, of course, have forgotten to get on the plane and the baggage is still on the jetway. But one of the things I read the other day that it never occurred to me until I read this, that the more people, the more businesses, the more organizations switch over to renewables, solar power, the less the revenue stream to the power grid drops. Because if I'm not using electricity from ESCOM or through the city, I'm not paying it, and I'm getting energy effectively, once you discount the cost of putting my stuff together to do it, I'm getting it for free, and I'm not paying ESCOM a penny. And the more people who switch over this way, the lower the revenue for the power utility is, which means it has less revenue to service those people who have not made the switch, or to rebuild its reticulation distribution network, or to upgrade its plants, or even to do its own switchovers to renewable and green energy technologies. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a hidden cost in the process of carrying out progress. I was astounded. I had never thought of that before.
No, it is a serious problem. Okay, let me start by saying, okay, I use the energy thing, obviously, as a kind of it is probably the most important metric that we really need to be focused on, because you've seen the estimations, even the Reserve Bank has been making, that we're losing easily like 2% GDP growth because of the whole issues of load shedding, etc. So it's an important metric. I'm not saying metrics around like fighting crime, etc., etc. So for me, it's an important one because it really feeds into issues around pushing the economy and obviously then raising employment levels, which for me would then be the shortest way of dealing with issues of poverty. I think inequalities is going to be a long-term kind of thing. But the point you're making is very true. And this is the unfortunate thing that, you know, and it's a little bit also about when we talk of the just part of the transition, you know, to a low carbon future, that there are going to be winners and losers, and that, you know, there's going to be a need to intervene in major ways. So you'd find that, you know, like often people would say, oh, there's lots of money going to the just transition. So, yes, it's true. But a lot of it's very focused around, say, the Mpumalanga kind of thing, you know, the whole ecosystem there, because of the direct impact it's going to have and will be having on the coal mining and the supply, the value chain into ESCOM and that kind of thing. So I think, you know, we need to manage that. We need to It's when saying that, I'm not saying, you know, like kick the can down the road kind of thing, but these are immediate things that we need to be dealing with. That if the price of energy goes up, if people are losing their jobs as we're making the moving to a just transition, and I know that there are concrete programs, particularly around coal mining sector, at reskilling workers, at making sure that, you know, the social net remains durable so that, you know, you can make sure that people that suffer job losses can survive for a while before other aspects of the economy take over. So it is, as usual, any massive transition like the one we're seeing and that we need to undertake even more seriously is going to have a lot of losers. But we need to make sure that some of the aspects are there. The ones that we can see are required. Social net, very important. Reskilling, very important. Looking at what are the new technologies that are made possible, new ways of employing that are made possible through new technologies become very important.
We're going to take a quick station break here and some commercial messages. We have to pay our piper. And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And today we're speaking with Dr. Yaqob Aba Omar, the operations head at MISTRA Mapungubwe, a think tank. A man who has had feet in the practicalities of government as well as the opportunity to think about the big issues. And we'll be right back and we'll continue our conversation.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and continuing our conversations as we have been in looking at the larger landscape of the electoral world. We're not going to talk about elections per se. We're going to talk about the landscape in which elections take place. And so we thought it was really good to have Yaqob Aba Omar from Mapungubwe to come talk about it. I'd heard a presentation he had given a year ago, setting out in a whole way of looking at the issues, challenges, stepping stones, giant mud holes, however you want to describe the challenges and the successes of South Africa as an economy, as a polity. And I thought, now it's a year later, let's talk to him again. You were talking about the changes in the nation as a result of all the challenges. And you mentioned reskilling, unemployment. I heard a presentation the other day from a senior diplomat in this country, and he said, we need to stop talking about unemployment. And we need to start looking at the challenges of employment. And he wasn't arguing that unemployment is not real. He read off the statistics, and they are horrifying. But he was saying the real challenge is in growing employment. That's where I think the South African government has had both a challenge, and I guess if we had to assign it a grade, they would not want to take that report card home to their parents.
I agree. And in fact, I must meet that ambassador because I agree completely with that approach. I think, as you know, I serve on the National Planning Commission, and in that arena, I head up what we call an employment scenarios team. And I've been quite clear that, you know, it's an employment scenarios team, because I agree with the ambassador that, you know, we tend to keep focusing on unemployment and the issues around that. And I think a lot of it's quite familiar territory. And, you know, our education system's not preparing people with the right skills, red tape, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the employment part is really requires that paradigm shift. And you say that, well, how do we go about it? And so amongst the big things, you know, we've been kind of debating is, you know, we start off, not start off, but often the observation is made that South African economy is over-concentrated. So, you know, big five, big six in the banking sector, big five, big six in the retail chains, et cetera, et cetera. In the interstices of the real world, you know, there's a whole lot of opportunities that we need to be encouraging, and they feed off a whole lot of them. But the key thing is to get the sense of being an enterprising nation, a nation that, you know, I know I was recently in Nairobi, and I think you've probably heard this as well, that, you know, the head of the Kenyan government is saying, oh, this is a hustle nation. And a lot of the people in Nairobi that I spoke to are like quite offended. And I can think that's such a nice metaphor of describing a nation that's, you know, willing to take chances and get things going. And they would say, nah, it just sounds like, you know, we don't have principle. And I just wish we had more of a hustle kind of mentality here. Now, that's not saying that we don't. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of especially young people that, you know, in our research, we have found that people, young people are shifting away from the, you know, wanting to be employed mainly by a big corporation or by government. And they want to be allowed to get on with their lives through a gig or some app or something, you know. And one which, you know, requires the least amount of mortar and cement, but, you know, often their costs would be data-based and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of simple sort of solutions at a level that we need to be kind of like addressing this employment thing. How do you just make it easier for people to employ? So obviously red tape issues, big ones. I mean, it's ridiculous the kind of reporting you need if someone, if you have a company that employs like a small kind of the minimum that's required. But yeah, you know, they're required to do the kind of same level of reporting that, you know, others are supposed to do. It's sort of like, you know, really, you know, they could, you know, they want, they can, they should be doing better with their time and that kind of thing. So I think, you know, there's a lot of that thing that we can do if we focus on employment, of creating jobs, creating enterprises that are allowed to employ people. Now, often, you know, as you know, with small enterprises, you know, you're going to go in with your cousin, brother, aunt, granny, whatever. But that's the way it should be. You know, it sort of, some of the research shows that you know, that there's a kind of disproportionately high level of women employed in the informal sector. And then they show a negative sort of income for that. But quite often, the income accrues to a household. So it's not coming to an individual. I'm making a long point about this, but basically saying that, you know, it's a survivalist game, you know, survivalist enterprises that should be allowed to get on. And then people get the dignity that come from work and entrepreneurship. Otherwise, we're stuck, you know, as good as our social net is. But people want to be able to say, look, I've earned this. You know, I've got the right to this money that I've got.
I once had a conversation with an actual venture capitalist, that rare breed of people that takes other people's money and basically gambles with it on technology or something. And the man in charge said to me, he said, look, in a lot of countries, you know, if you fail at a business, that's it. You're done. Nobody will ever talk to you again. Nobody will ever lend you money. Nobody will ever. You're done. In my game, I don't even talk to anybody who hasn't failed once or twice, because failing is a way of learning what to do right. I mean, assuming you've learned something from your failure, that's the kind of person I want. I want someone who can say, all right, I did something wrong. I've learned about it. Now I'm going to do it right with somebody else's money. And this, that in a way is the new version of an entrepreneurial culture. Right. We're going to take a short break and I'll let you come back on this in a second. But first we'll go to station IDs and commercial messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and I'm delighted to have as our guest today, Dr. Yaacob Abba Omar of Mapungubwe. And we're talking about, well, we're talking about everything, really. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today, Yaacob Abba Omar of Mistra or Mapungubwe. And we were talking about creating a job-centric, a job creating culture, an entrepreneurial culture. I read something somewhere in the U.S., 80% of small businesses fail in 5 years, but those people don't go into hibernation or die. They start all over again doing something else. Mm-hmm. And yet, I do not yet see in this country that sort of ethos anymore. I think it used to be there, but I'm not sure it is anymore. Can you get out of that bind in this country? Is there a way forward to make this a job-generating culture?
Yes, there is. But I think not in the way we've been traditionally kind of approaching it. You know, so government sets up a small business ministry, and the only job they create is a whole lot of bureaucrats and that kind of thing. It says we're going to go for 100 black industrialists. And so, you know, there's obviously a role to be played by government, but it needs to be more of an enabling, empowering role, you know. So, for example, you know, the presidency actually had a former CEO in the mining sector, Sipho Nkosi, to come and be the red tape czar in the presidency. And, you know, I don't know when last you've heard of him, Brooks, but you know, I think he just got caught up in the red tape within union buildings as well. So I think, you know, we really need to shift that mindset. It's not easy, but I have a lot of optimism amongst the young people who, out of desperation, sheer desperation, you know, either come out of school or out of universities and, you know, no one's employing them, or even while at university beginning to play around with ideas and things like that. So I think that's a big one for me. I think, you know, and it's kind of weird, not weird. And the sad reality also is that crime plays a big role. You know, the go-go selling the fat cook is so exposed to criminal elements at the bus rank, you know, that kind of thing. So so you need a kind of, at one level, a holistic thing, but I don't like too holistic an approach. Otherwise, we just get paralyzed and not doing anything. But trying to find ways that young people, and as I say, the trends are there, you know, that's where it's going. We should just nudge it along in that way. So create more incentives for them, support them, make it easier for them to hustle and you know, do things and so forth.
Move this conversation a little bit toward the political realm, because we are in that electoral cycle. Given these economic circumstances and one of the major international financial agencies reevaluated South Africa's growth and said, actually, it's going to be less than we said last year, which was a pretty horrifying number before they said it was going to be less. What impact does this all have on the political texture of the country? I mean, we see lots of new mini parties. I don't, you know, like six guys in a photocopying machine. But what are we going to do? What is going to happen politically?
And I think you're right to locate that question within this broader economic, socioeconomic milieu. And, you know, you kind of reference some of the work I've been doing on scenarios. So one of the big projects has been the Indlulamithi scenarios project. And so we've kind of been having soft sort of launches of this, a new set of scenarios we have developed. And the one is what we call the Hadida scenarios. In fact, they're all named after birds. And as you know,
Hadidas live outside my house. So
exactly. And they're loud and so forth. So in that scenario, we kind of saying, well, you know, the ANC will just manage to attain, or maybe with one or two small parties, a majority and still run government. But it kind of goes down, you know, in its normal kind of stasis kind of way, and that it doesn't really go far. So we're saying that's almost like your status quo scenario. Things just, it's worse down the line. And, you know, the figures that you cited, then we say it could go really bad, and we refer to this as the vulture culture. And in that one, you know, we've got a situation where the ANC doesn't win. There's a coalition that comes in and, you know, made up of these, one or two large parties, but also a whole lot of other small parties that then promises, tries to move towards a slightly more pop, because of the internal dynamics, move towards more populist approaches as far as a whole lot of decisions are concerned around the macroeconomy and that kind of thing. But growth doesn't happen. And so, and they're unable, because of the corruption already within elements of that alliance, that they aren't able to stop the corruption actually deepening. So it's like my turn to eat kind of thing that emerges. And that becomes more and more authoritarian as people, you know, start revolting. Things. The third one is the one where the ANC is sort of, again, not doing well, but realizes that by 2029, it actually needs to be working in a closer alliance with other parties. So, and we don't say which parties make up this thing, but by 2029, we see the emergence of what we call a Concord government, and where they're able to arrive at a combination of social democratic approaches, very pro-market and able to bring in business and state managerial kind of capacity to start resolving the problem. So by 2029, that becomes possible, because I think, and to refer to your photocopy and five people parties, you know, people by 2020 realize there's no point in trying to waste your vote, in a sense, supporting the small and the other party, that, you know, you should actually continue supporting the larger parties so that they can get something together. And then some of the smaller parties just fade out, you know, after a day or two of publicity and that kind of thing. So my feeling is that, you know, for example, and if I could be quite specific, you know, I think Rais Mzansi is a really good concept. But I really, and you know, even when Songezo Zibi was busy talking about establishing this thing, he and Tessa Dooms and so forth were going around talking about setting up the Livonia Circle. And we began picking up things about, you know, they were thinking about moving to the political domain. And that's the last thing you want to do. You know, it's so difficult, you know, to get in and have a platform in parliament and that kind of thing. And I know there's an idealism that's firing up somewhere. So, you know, he says he wants young people to feel that it's good to be involved in politics, and he wants to make a difference, etc. But I kept feeling that, you know, we need to rather be strengthening civil society, because our civil society side has become so emasculated and denuded that, you know, we need to prop that up. So I think that's the one thing. Then, you know, you get the Roger Jardine phenomenon, sort of doesn't wake up, but, you know, has a razzmatazz kind of launch and that kind of thing. And then, you know, we don't hear from them again for a while. And, you know, so, and I think just the way it's done and so forth. And so I think there's a lot of people, a lot of parties, organizations, individuals that are smelling blood and like sharks going around this caucus of the ANC, think that, okay, well, you know, we can take over the levers of power, etc. It's not going to be easy. You know, I still remember a moment when I was ambassador in Abu Dhabi and we were hosting Helen Ziller, and, you know, normal ambassador and guest of honor. So we're sitting in the car and she's having to take calls, and obviously, you know, assured her confidentiality. And so I wouldn't say what she was dealing with, but she turned to me at some point and she says, you know, people just don't realize how difficult it is to build a party and to run a party. And, you know, for me, that's remained quite an important point that, you know, even if you look at the ANC, you know, people look about at its performance at the 2021 local government election. The sheer weaknesses within that party, the fact that you didn't have an effective engine room in terms of the Secretary General's office, one factor had such a huge impact on the rest of its mobilization and its operational machinery and that kind of thing. So I think it's tough. It's democracy at work, you know, all these independents that are coming on and other parties that are coming on, et cetera, et cetera. But my sense is that by, you know, yes, it'll happen in this election. It may take away from some of the key parties like the DA and the ANC some votes, because you're going to find there are people that are vying. Say, if you take the Patriotic Alliance Party that's vying for the colored vote of that the DA has been depending on in parts of the Western Cape. If you look at the Freedom Front plus people, they are trying to win over some of the white Afrikaner vote and colored vote, by the way, back to this Afrikaner kind of thing.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and our guest today, Dr. Yaqub Abba Omar, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. And my guest today, Dr. Yaqub Abba Omar, the operations manager, and I suspect one of the chief intellectual motors inside the Mapungubwe Institute. He's got all this wonderful experience in government, outside of government, as a researcher, as a diplomat for South Africa. And he's an active, how should we say, scenario planner, futurist, futurologist, prognosticator, hovers over the Ouija board to try to figure things out. And we were talking before our break about the curve of political parties, and that major parties have more staying power, if for no other reason than they have more history, they have more infrastructure, they have more people who are committed to their vision or competing to be controlling their vision. But above all, they have a track record, good or bad, they have a track record, and they have people who adhere to their vision or visions. South Africa these days, as everybody knows, has this plethora of new small parties of some rather bright people who are trying hard to figure out how to bring new and interesting ideas, in many cases, into the political sphere. But it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard road for them. And so if we listen to Dr. Abba Omar, we are looking at a political structure, at least for this election and probably the next one, in which the landscape will largely be what it was before. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. So, yes, I think it's going to be largely the same. I think there's, but you know, the kind of shape, the kind of shifting, in a sense, is going to be a lot internal to ANC, DA in particular, and then obviously EFF, because I think those would be like the three major parties that, you know, will probably emerge. But I think, you know, the DA, it's so let me start with ANC. There's, the president, the leadership of the ANC speak about its renewal, et cetera, et cetera. And I know sometimes when you're outside it, it's like watching paint drying, and it, like, you don't see the difference. But, you know, one gets a sense that, you know, whatever foot and mouth disease that the Secretary General of the ANC may be suffering from, but it is brought in a kind of dimension of alignment, let me call it, from between the leadership, national leadership, down to the branch level, that, that, you know, we kind of feel that it's kind of getting its act together in many ways. And I think it pulled out all the stops for the January 8th celebration at the Mbombela Stadium. You know, so it can do that. So I think that's the one thing. The other thing is, you know, it's taking seriously some of its own internal resolutions about the quality of people that they wouldn't want to put up into the election list and that kind of thing. So I think there's that kind of changes that are happening. I think the Youth League, for example, you know, the president of the Youth League has turned down any invitation to be on the national list of the ANC, saying he's got a lot of work to do, you know, as far as strengthening the Youth League is concerned. And you know, as I mentioned before, for me, a lot is what happens in that youth space is going to be important. So I think that's important. I think the DA needs to confront this kind of crisis that it has, that you've got the colored base being dropped in two directions. One is the Freedom Front Plus direction, because I think, you know, that this large number, particularly of the Western Cape colored, that would speak Afrikaans as their first language. And there's been a little bit of discomfort about the DA being largely English white, and that even though the DA has tried to kind of incorporate a lot more of the Afrikaans kind of. So I think that's the one. And then the Patriotic Alliance, with all its rhetoric and that kind of thing, has also been, and sadly, you know, I mean, just horribly kind of xenophobic in their attitudes and action and that kind of thing. Action SA is obviously quite important, because they kind of, you know, talk a lot to urban Blacks in particular, but also colored Indian kind of thing. And then so I think these elements are going to kind of have an impact on the DA, the support it garners in the election. I must tell you a very quick, funny story, if I can. I love traveling through the countryside. So we often go down by road through from Joburg to Cape Town, and we went into one of the little dorpies at the time of the local government election. And my wife is bilingual in the sense of English, Afrikaans speaking. And, we saw like the Freedom Front posters had for the local government election had so many colored faces. And she was like, you know, I think that's the party I'm back and join. I would love to run a little town. So I said, yeah, and you could be the plus in the Freedom Front. And I think that's the kind of thing that the colors are coming in, but they're feeling more comfortable. With the kind of conservative Christian kind of approaches that the Freedom Front Plus demonstrates. The other useful thing of the Freedom Front Plus is that it's got a lot of people that have been, albeit, you know, in the apartheid government, but they've been in government. You know, they know what it requires. And so they come across as a lot more measured and that kind of thing. So I think that kind of attracts the more conservative voters as well.
What you're really telling me is don't look for any radical, don't look for any visionary changes. Look for more of the same, but look for nibbling at the edges of everything. No vast reshuffle. I'm not even going to put you on the spot with percentages because it's too far in advance. But what I want to ask you is, and by extension, in the U.S., in the United States, traditionally, the argument has been, as we get to an election, that it is, as the sign in the Clinton campaign headquarters memorably said, it's the economy, stupid, which was shorthand for saying that when it comes right down to it, people vote on the economy. And most importantly, they vote on their own kitchen table circumstances. Prices up, prices down. John's got a job, Billy doesn't. They vote on whether or not it's too costly to get a loan to buy a house or to refinance a car or even to pay for something on layaway. But most analysts in America are now saying that, yes, the economy is something of a paradox because all the numbers say the economy is doing well with modest footnotes. But the two issues that are motivating Americans to vote one way or the other, the immigration crisis at the border and the question of women's reproductive rights rather than straightforwardly economic issues. They both have economic handles to them, but they are not economic issues in specific terms. What is the big, if you had to put your finger on it in the remaining time, what is the big issue we have? And we're going to take one quick break just before, think about it for a second. I'll give you a couple of seconds to think on this one, but we'll take a quick break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. My guest today is Yaakob Abba Omar from Mistra or Mapungubwe. And I've given him an assignment and we'll hear the answer just after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and our guest today, political prognosticator, futurologist, scenario planner, Yaakob Abba Omar of Mistra. And I gave him an assignment at the last break, and now is the drum roll ready for the answer.
So two caveats I should have mentioned from your earlier comment about me being the intellectual person. I often describe myself as the pretty face in Mistra because, you know, I'm the one that has to do all the operational stuff and things. But as you can imagine, I do enjoy engaging in intellectual debates and doing my own research. I think the key issues are commonly understood. Employment, economy, so that kind of goes together. But I think people experience it, as you're saying, as employment. Crime, corruption, hugely important. Load shedding, and now water. So I think these are the three, four issues that have been coming up in terms of the kind of research that polling institutes have been doing about the key problem. But I think the point you're making about like the US sort of thing, the immigration and so forth, notwithstanding the issue that those are the things that people are most concerned about, there is also, and you know, like we spoke earlier about the kind of color vote going this way and the Indian vote going this way and that, and the real importance of identity. And I think that's something. So I was doing a presentation to the United Nations country team in Pretoria, and I was describing some of these dynamics to them, and they said, "But you know, you're like only talking about the sort of racial dynamics." And I said, "Yes, it's still a really important issue." And so there's a socioeconomic overlay, obviously. And you'd find like that, you know, some of, like, for example, people get surprised even up to now that young Black professionals prefer voting for the EFF because they feel that they are the ones that are really talking transformation language, you know. And so often people think, oh, you know, the EFF, they go to the squatter camps and, you know, they're getting support there, et cetera, et cetera. But surprisingly high level of support that they draw from those kind of areas where you'd find that kind of thing. So I would say identity and the way people would look at, and, you know, in South Africa, the big divide is the racial divide. It's so enduring. You know, we keep wanting to wish it away and toss it over and that kind of thing. But I think it shapes the way people see things in so many ways. So when people were listening, for example, to the Human Rights Commission and the CRL report on the July 2021 riots, a lot of people wanted to hear the racial dimension. You know, like with and a lot of the debates, you know, you may have watched it over the radio and TV and that kind of thing, where, well, are these Indians racist? They're the ones that are committing murders and attacking people, et cetera, and that kind of thing. So we still got that as a big issue. And then obviously, you know, you've got certain sort of ethnic elements and tribal elements. So I think in KZN, it's sort of, it's a bit, a lot of race, but a strong element of the kind of Zulu identity factor that's going to play in. And, you know, I think, for example, I think, you know, that, you know, the observers are saying it wasn't a good move for the ANC not to have someone from KwaZulu-Natal in their top seven, you know. And I think, you know, that's going to feed into a whole lot of issues in terms of whether the ANC is supported or in Qatar or the MK party is supported in that sort of situation.
I'm fascinated by all this. I wish we had hours more, but we don't, and I know you don't as well. And so we're going to have to break it here and say we'll have to have you back again to move further into these dimensions. My guest today, Dr. Yaqob Abba Omar, futurologist, scenario planner, gazer into the crystal ball. My crystal ball doesn't help very much because it's all smudge. Somebody put peanut butter on it, so it doesn't show me anything. But his is clearer than mine, and I think we're going to have to listen to him further. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week at this time. And thank you for listening.